So for those of you who'd like to join in, we're going to do the four-line prayer, taking refuge in generating bodhicitta. And the way I'd like to do it today is similar to what we did the other day, and that is just recite it once in English and then repeat the last line of it a total of three times. Okay? I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. So about today's schedule, it's scheduled to go from now until noon, and so we'll have a break roughly midway through. In the previous sessions that I've had here, the break has been very, very short, just a kind of stand and stretch break. But because this session is longer, we'll have a longer break, about maybe 15 minutes or something like that. So then there might be more time for them to relax and refresh yourself and so forth, get a drink or whatever is necessary. Right. So today we have the handout that I had prepared for this weekend, but for technical reasons it wasn't available yesterday, but now it is available, thanks to the technical expertise of David, and I would like to first point out what is contained in the handout, and then start approaching different parts of it. Okay? So just first to go through what the handout contains. It's five sides long. So the first side, as it's stated, are a few introductory notes on mind training. So these are a selection of quotations or comments which set the whole practice of mind training into its proper context. Okay? Starting with a comment by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which I was talking about at the very end of last night's session, and I'd like to begin with that. Okay? Then the next two pages, pages 2 and 3, is a transcription of a letter I wrote to the father of a friend of mine many years ago who asked for a few words on emptiness. So these are the few words on emptiness. As we'll see in a moment, this fits in again with the topic that we'll be discussing. Okay. Then on page 4 is the abbreviated outline of Geshe Chikawa's 7-point mind training. This is the text that was advertised that I would be teaching on. Right? Advertisements aren't always completely truthful, only because the teacher doesn't always follow those instructions. But definitely we'll be touching on this. And it is an abbreviated. Outlines themselves, of course, are abbreviated, but this is even more abbreviated because certain parts of these 7 points will be discussed in greater length. Others will be discussed only in passing. So we'll go through, we'll have reason for referring to that, this outline. And then the fifth page is applying the 5 powers. And if you look back on page 4, section of the outline, number 4 is elucidating a lifetime's practice. You see that? And under it, it says applying the five powers, or sometimes called the five forces, before the time of death and near the time of death. And that's what's expanded upon on page 5, applying those five powers at those two times. And one of the reasons that I've kind of jumped into this part of the outline is because for, I think many, many people find that it's the material contained in this section of the 7-point mind training that is, for want of a better word, the most practical. You know, people, when they study the Dharma, they say, okay, I'm studying the Dharma, I'm learning the Dharma, but how do I practice the Dharma? How do I apply it to everyday life? And this section, section 4, elucidating a lifetime's practice, is designed to pretty much answer that question. Okay, now that we have some kind of Dharma background, what is the practical applicability of it? And though every part of the teaching is meant to be practical advice, this section 4, elucidating a lifetime's practice, really focuses in on that question. And so that's why I want to spend more time on that, because I think it would be you know, of kind of greater interest. Okay? And before we leave the outline, I just want to point out something else that I made very brief reference to. If you see the second section called the main practice, you know, on the outline, the main practice, it's cultivating the awakening mind, or bodhicitta, and then there are two types of awakening mind that are discussed. One is called the ultimate awakening mind, and the other is the conventional awakening mind. And generally speaking, when the term bodhicitta is used, we talk about meditating on bodhicitta, cultivating the compassionate bodhicitta attitude, it's really the conventional bodhicitta which is meant. It's that motivation and all the practices that follow from that compassionate motivation to attain enlightenment for the sake of benefiting others. That is the general definition, the general usage of bodhicitta. But there is also a way of using that term bodhicitta to indicate the ultimate awakening mind. And so that is the understanding of the nature of reality, or we could say the wisdom of emptiness, in the mind of someone who's training on the bodhisattva path. Okay? So the motivation for such a person is to win enlightenment for the sake of others. So the motivation is the conventional bodhicitta, as we ordinarily understand it. But the wisdom understanding, you know, of that mind is the ultimate bodhicitta. So here, ultimate bodhicitta becomes a synonym for the wisdom of emptiness. And that's why on the earlier pages, you know, pages 2 and 3, a few words of emptiness come in. So it ties together. It isn't quite as random as it might appear, or as random as I ordinarily speak, either for that matter. Okay. All right. So before we turn to this material, is there any question or anything that needs clarification before we actually begin? I'd be very, yes, please.
The little video you talked about, with the Dalai Lama.
Can you wait for the microphone for people who are speaking?
Okay.
The little video that you told us about with the Dalai Lama explaining Om Mani Padme Om is charming and delightful.
Oh, you went and
looked
it up?
It up this morning.
Yeah, it's about 5 or 6 minutes long.
Yeah, 5 minutes and 20 some odd seconds. It's fabulous.
Yeah, and the young woman who stands up and asks that question, she's quite brave. Has a very large congregation of people, and she went up to ask a question, which at first, you know, the At first, the Dalai Lama's response was not to explain what the mantra meant, but just to talk about how important it was to have an understanding. And only then, when she asked, kind of repeated the question, then did he actually give the explanation of what the mantra meant. So I thought it was very, very, very instructive, a very good dialogue myself. And I quite admired her for the way she asked that question. It must have been a little bit scary, I would think. Yeah. And then did you catch where in the explanation that quotation that I used came from? Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So if anybody else is interested in seeing that 5 or 6 minute video, the way I look it up is just go to YouTube and or Google, whatever, and just plug in the Dalai Lama on the Mani Mantra, or something like that, and it'll come up. Is that how you found it?
I plugged in Dalai Lama Om Mani Padme
Hum. Yeah.
There was a whole bunch of stuff.
Right. Okay. But then it's fairly easy to find which is the one that I was referring to. Okay. Thank you for that. And anything else before we begin? Okay. And also, one thing I'd like to remind you is during whatever presentation I give, it sometimes may happen that I use a term without bothering to define it, because after so many years, I kind of think that the words are English, even if they're Tibetan or Sanskrit. Or there might even be a term in English which is not common in English, but I think it's common because I've heard it for so many, you know, for so many years. So if I ever do that, if I ever say something, and in your mind you think, what does that phrase mean? What does that word mean? And if I don't pause and define it right away, please, you know, please raise your hand and point that out to me. Because I try to make things as clear and easy to understand as I can, but sometimes I lose sight of the fact of where everyone is in their background. So, if I use a term and it remains unclear, then don't just sit with the unclarity for the rest of the hour, or wait for the question and answer session later on, but just point that out to me right away. That would actually be very, 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 very helpful. I would not consider that at all an interruption. I would consider that a great benefit, a great support. Okay? Yes, please.
I have a vocabulary word right away.
Oh, good.
Yesterday, I thought I heard the word cloying several times, and I'm not familiar with that English word.
I've heard that word used when you're eating something sweet, but it's too sweet. So instead of getting the pleasure of it being sweet, it's kind of cloying. It's like too much. That's how I understand the word. Is that how you understand it
as
well?
Thank you.
Cloying is the stick. So it's a sweetness that sticks and you can't.
Oh, you mean sticking.
Well, I mean, that's the note. I mean, to cloy.
Oh.
To kind of... Something that's cloyingly sweet, it's like...
No, I never knew that was where that word comes from.
It's just a nice word.
Okay. So, I'm going to start just where we... left off last night, because we left off just by reading this quotation, so I'll read it again. As the Dalai Lama has pointed out, the whole Buddhist system is to utilize our human intelligence in the maximum way, and by doing so, to transform our emotions. That is the Buddhist approach. Such intelligence, that maximum intelligence, enables us to discriminate correctly between that which leads to suffering and that which is to be avoided, and that which leads to happiness and is to be practiced. Okay. Now, One of the thoughts behind a statement such as this is that before the arisal of any emotion, and here we're going to specifically focus on the destructive emotions, you know, that which we want to avoid because they lead to suffering, you know, such as anger, jealousy, and so forth. Before the arisal of such an emotion, there is already present in the mind some kind of view, some kind of attitude. Now, that doesn't mean that it's well thought out or that we have a specific enunciated philosophy of life. You know, it doesn't have to be that. It can just be an attitude that we have. And in many cases, we're not even aware that we have this attitude. But from the Buddhist point of view, prior to any emotion that arises, and prior to any action that we engage in, there is a view present. And the Buddha pointed out that there are three distorted views which are present, can be present prior to the attainment of liberation and enlightenment, which cause us to speak and act in a way that brings suffering. And so this human intelligence that the Dalai Lama uses is not aimed at suppressing any emotion. You know, it's not like, oh, I feel a certain way, but now I have to use my intelligence to overcome that emotion. It's not that. It's to use the intelligence to discern what is the subtle, probably hidden view which is causing my mind to go in the direction of that destructive emotion. And if we can oppose those mistaken views with the correct one, then it's as if we're not suppressing a negative emotion, but we're short-circuiting it. We're pulling the rug out from under it. Okay? So the next few paragraphs I'm going to read from, because I think it gives more of a understanding of what I just said in an introductory manner. So number two says, the various disturbing emotions, so those are the emotions we're particularly interested in alleviating, also called the delusions or afflictions, which are responsible for our suffering and dissatisfaction. These disturbing emotions arise when our mind clings to a distorted view of reality. In other words, a distorted view of how things actually exist. So that's just another way of stating what I had mentioned before, that without that distorted view, there's no way for those destructive emotions to arise. Okay? So we're going to aim our weapon not so much at the emotion as whatever the distorted view is that gave rise to that emotion. So it's kind of, in a way, it's a kind of an exploration. It's a digging expedition. We take the arisal of that negative emotion, like the hatred that we're feeling, or the impatience that we're feeling, or the jealousy that we're feeling, or whatever that emotion is, and we take that as a kind of a red flag. Oh, that must be a sign that something in my view of reality is distorted, right? Because otherwise, at least according to the teachings that we're studying, there would be no way for that emotion to arise. It has to somehow or other depend on a distorted view. So we shift our attention from the distorted emotion itself, noting that it is, disturbing emotion itself, you know, noting that it is disturbing, that it is a delusion or an affliction, and then we start to search, well, what distorted view or views might be present causing my mind to go in the direction of such a disturbing emotion. Okay? So, The next several sections describe how to understand what these distorted views are, or what they might, or what might be present causing these disturbing emotions to arise. Okay, so we're on number three now. So, for example, although all phenomena appearing to our five physical sense and five, I can see I'm having trouble with my articulation this morning, appearing to our five physical senses, although they are impermanent, in other words, changing from moment to moment, we mistakenly view them as permanent and unchanging. Okay? So, a little bit background on this, though many of you have already received many teachings on impermanence. It's one of the main teachings of the Buddha. It was present in the very first teaching he gave, and the very, very last utterance of the Buddha. You know? The last thing he said before entering into the meditations that led him into parinirvana, or the passing away of an enlightened being, was, all compounded phenomena are impermanent. Work out your own salvation with diligence. So clearly the Buddha thought that this was an extremely important point. If he taught it throughout his entire 45 years of teaching and then repeated it fundamentally on his deathbed, or between his two death trees, as it was. He wasn't really on a bed. Okay. He was lying between two trees in Kushinagar. Okay? So, to ground this a little bit in experience, intellectually, it is not that difficult to recognize that everything that we see, right, and everything that we hear, and everything that we smell, taste, and touch, all of these phenomena are momentary. They're sensations which arise for a moment, abide for a moment, and then dissolve again. You know? And sometimes they give the impression of being long-lasting, because after they subside, then they'll arise again. You know, so it's something like flickering on and off gives the impression of being continuous. But in fact, all these phenomena are momentary. And this is something, the Buddha and other great teachers talked about thousands of years ago, but it's something that in the last few hundred years has been shown to be absolutely true on very, very subtle and pervasive levels. So that, for example, a scientist can take something that looks really heavy and solid and permanent, you know, like a piece of lead, for example, you know, and can explore it with the use of instruments such as electron microscopes and so forth, and discover that what appears to be so solid and unchanging is in fact undergoing constant change. That the molecules are made up of atoms, which are made up of subatomic particles, which last for, in some cases, just billionths of a second. And so, even though from the macro vision, it looks permanent and solid and unchanging, as soon as our vision becomes micro, we see that it's in a constant state of change, which is what Buddha referred to as subtle impermanence. Now, there's also gross impermanence, and an example of that would be, I always like to think of a purchase that requires quite a lot of money, and that afterwards we have the pride of ownership. So let's say, a shiny new car, but it could be anything. It could be anything. You know, a new suit of clothes, whatever it might be. So, we've purchased this item. I'll stick with a car just to keep the example simple. And when we were thinking of buying the car, we were probably influenced by the advertisements for this model car that we'd see in a magazine. And it's all glossy and it's lit very nicely, you know, and looks very, very attractive. And then when we go to the showroom, there in person is that image, you know, perfectly shiny, you know, like that. And so it doesn't appear to be undergoing momentary disintegration, you know. When we look at it sitting there, either in the picture or in the showroom, its subtle impermanence, the fact that it's changing from moment to moment, is not appearing, right? We just see a surface image. And eventually we purchase it, and now we not only think that it's a permanently beautiful object, you know, we think it's my permanently beautiful object, you know. Now we're looking at it from that point of view, okay, something that now belongs to me. You know, before we signed the contract, we didn't conceive of it as being mine, but now we look at it as being mine, right? So that attribute of this car belonging to me is something that came afterwards. It's a projection of our own mind. And then we have this car sitting in our driveway or wherever we park it, and for a long time we have that pride of ownership because it maintains that outward look of a new car, a brand new car, you know. But sooner or later, and usually more sooner than later, something happens. And what that something is basically gross impermanence. You know, the subtle impermanence was there all the time. You know, no matter when we train our electron microscope on that car, we're going to see that it's constantly undergoing change. But at some point, that change becomes obvious. Something gets scratched or dented or breaks down. And then that's when we notice its impermanent nature. That's when this object that we prize can give rise to great disappointment because it's no longer what we were purchasing. Because what we were purchasing in our own mind was not an impermanent connection, an impermanent collection of metal and wood and plastic and so forth, which eventually is going to break down. That's not what we thought we were purchasing. What we thought we were purchasing was a car, a good-looking car, you know, something kind of that will retain that beauty, you know, that efficiency. So we bought something which is in fact impermanent, thinking, not intellectually thinking, but with the attitude of it being its image. The image is unchanging, but the reality is changing every moment. Okay? So when that happens, when something that we thought was unchanging shows its impermanent nature, if we're not prepared for that, you know, if we haven't spent some time meditating on impermanence, that can be tremendously disappointing. Now, I use that example in terms of a physical object, like a car that we buy, but we apply that same kind of attitude towards our relationship with other people, you know? And that's quite obvious. If we can't see it in our own relationships, then all we have to do is open up People magazine, you know, and it's there for us to read, you know, in full color every week, virtually every day, you know, is there's two young, good-looking, I don't know, I'll call them Hollywood stars, you know, and they've seen each other, maybe because they've worked on a movie together, and oh, it's so romantic, they've fallen in love, you know. And then there's quotations from each of them, how beautiful the other person is. And then after a while, they decide to get married. And then they have this most gorgeous millions of dollars wedding, you know, and the magazine starts gushing over everything that's present there, you know. And so that's one week, right? And then a few weeks or at most a few months down the line, you pick up another copy of People magazine, and now that these two people are in court with each other, you know, slandering each other. How could I possibly have shown interest in this bozo? You know, he's such a cheating fool and like that, you know? And so, obviously, there's some disappointment there. And what we could say happened, without, you know, without trying to psychoanalyze people that I've never met, what we could say, in all likelihood, is that let's say from the point of view of the man, just to simplify the explanation, from the man's point of view, he wasn't marrying that woman. He was marrying an image of that woman. The woman is an impermanent phenomenon. The image is this really beautiful Hollywood starlight. Starlet, you know, with beautiful hair, beautiful face, and beautiful figure, and beautiful way of speaking, right? That's the image. The reality is that this is an impermanent human being, you know, who is growing older every second, whose flawless skin is probably the product of a lot of cosmetic work, you know, and who sooner or later will start showing crow's feet and wrinkles and all the changes which are part of being an impermanent phenomenon, right? But the person that that man married, well, what that man married was not the person in his mind, but that image, that kind of perfect photographic image, right? And so there's a great disparity between the image that's been appropriated and the reality. And so when the reality begins to show itself in the form of aging and so forth, then there's great disappointment. There's a famous quotation I read quite a number of years ago about one of the great screen goddesses from the 1940s. I think that's when she was mainly famous, Rita Hayworth. The movie, which I think she's the most famous for, is called Gilda. And she's a very, very gorgeous creature, especially in that movie. And later on in her life, Rita Hayworth had a very unhappy life. She had several failed marriages, and there was many things that happened to her that were quite sad. And she was discussing with someone her life, and she was talking about her failed relationships, and she said, "The problem is that men go to sleep. Men fall in love with and go to sleep with Gilda, and the next morning when they wake up, they find only me." Right? Which is a really disturbing thing, isn't it? You know, that not to be loved for who you really are, but to be mistaken for some kind of static image of what you appear to be. Okay? And of course, everything that I said from the man's point of view towards the women, exactly the same thing is true from the women's point of view to the men, that it can be a case where instead of having the reality of knowing, well, this is another human being like myself, has good parts, has bad parts, all of which is undergoing change, is being intoxicated or infatuated with a surface image. And that surface image, to the extent that we hold on to it as being true, is a distorted vision of reality. Okay? So if we hold on to such a distorted vision, that automatically gives rise to disturbing emotions when that image crumbles. Does that make sense? You know? We wouldn't feel that disappointment if we, from the beginning, we're not buying into that view of permanence, what Lama Yeshe used to call the permanent conception, the permanent conception. Of course, Lama didn't mean that the conception was permanent. He means that the conception of permanence is then projected onto various objects. So he used to talk about that permanent conception as being something that we do kind of instinctively that causes dissatisfaction to arise. Sooner or later, it becomes the cause of dissatisfaction and all the various related disturbing emotions that come with that. So when the Dalai Lama says to use our intelligence to the maximum extent to transform our emotions, one of the things that he can be referring to is a situation in which we use our intelligence to recognize that all these phenomena that make up our physical universe, let's say, are undergoing constant change, that nothing stays the same from moment to moment. And if we have that clear vision, then we won't be so easily seduced by the permanent conception, right? And so if that conception of permanence is not strong in us, if it just arises a little bit and then we can dismiss it, we can cut through with it with our intelligence, or if we reach a point where it doesn't arise at all, then all the various disturbing emotions which would arise from such a misconception don't arise. They have no basis for it, right? So remember, what I said before was that this view that we're talking about isn't a necessarily well-thought-out philosophical position. It can be. There are philosophies in the world which set out certain views, and some of them may accord with reality, but a lot of them don't really accord with reality. And we might fall under the influence of those philosophical views. That's possible. But even someone who's never heard a word of philosophy, you know, and has never consciously taken aboard any philosophical position, still, you know, when they see an object, it appears to them to be permanent, for example. And so there's this subtle view that it is as it appears to be. So, for example, if someone were to walk into the room right now, and we see this person, Frank, just to give it a name, and then a little while later, Frank leaves, let's say for the break, and then comes back in after the break, well, that's still Frank, isn't it? Yeah. But the person who came in is not exactly the same person who went out. And yet, looks obviously similar enough, is dressed the same, has the same general shape, expression, and so forth, tone of voice. So we think that's Frank. And on a conventional level, that's true. Right? If we were to be mathematically minded, we might say, well, the first Frank that we saw was Frank sub 1. And this later one who came 15 minutes later, this is Frank sub 2, giving us an idea that there's a continuity, but a difference between what we first saw and what we saw the second time. Right? But generally speaking, we don't engage in that kind of minute observation, do we? So we think, I saw this person last year, I'm seeing that person again this year. Or in my case, here, this visit to the Kadampa Center is my first since 20 years ago, 1996, right? And I've met a few old friends, and I recognize them as being the old friends that I met 20 years ago. And I must say, they haven't changed as much as I think I've changed in 20 years. But they have changed, obviously. They're 20 years older. Okay, but it still recognizes being the same person, right? And then I feel I'm the same person. And yet, of course, there has been oceans and oceans of changes between then and now. Okay, so holding on tightly to a distorted vision of reality And the first one that's mentioned here is this so-called permanent conception, the conception that things are unchanging, is a cause, one of the causes which gives rise to the disturbing emotions. Okay? So to continue on from section 3, so for example, although all phenomena appearing to our five physical senses are impermanent, in other words, changing from moment to moment, we mistakenly view them as permanent and unchanging. Mm-hmm. By the way, I just want to add another sentence here from Lama Yeshe at this point. In a number of his teachings, including one that's included in Introduction to Tantra, the Lama Yeshe says very, very pointedly, whenever we have a fixed view of anything, we are hallucinating. So that's Lama's summary, a very incisive summary. It's a hallucination. The fixed view is a hallucination. It is not reality. You know? So that has many, many implications. Okay. So to continue, as a result of this distorted view, we exaggerate the badness of an unattractive object and the goodness of an attractive object, causing us to generate anger towards the former and desirous attachment towards the latter. Okay? So in this world of ours, we see all sorts of things, we run into all sorts of things, and some of them appear to be rather pleasant, and we tend to think, oh, that's nice, that's good. And some appear to be unpleasant. You know, it's the way we react to them. Okay? And so we might think, oh, that's bad. Basically what we're saying is, I like this, I don't like that. Okay? Now, if that's as far as it went, right? In other words, we're just being honest with ourselves about our preferences. That I prefer this to that, I like this, I don't like that. That would be kind of just an honest statement of our reaction to it, right? And if in the back of our mind, we also realize, well, even that impression is impermanent, we might not always think that this is pleasant and the other is unpleasant, but for the time being, I kind of like this and I don't like that. Like when I was a kid and still now, there are certain foods that I like the taste of, and other foods that I didn't, you know. It wasn't the cause for great anxiety. It's just, if I had my preference, I would eat this and not that, you know. In time, very often my tastes changed, and things which I couldn't stand as a kid, I now like, and things that I liked as a kid, such as very sweet things, I find cloying, right? You know, so those things change. But just simply noting, I like this, I don't like that, that itself is not a delusion, right? But when it's coupled with this permanent conception, then something that looks attractive, something that I like, you know, seems to be inherently good, you know, and we exaggerate the value of that goodness. We think it's not only good, it's great. Right? You know? I think of the kid who looks at something, and it could be a toy, a birthday cake, could be anything, you know, with those big eyes, those huge saucer eyes, like they want to devour it because it's an image for them of ultimate goodness, right? I've got to have that last piece of that birthday cake, right? Even if it means knocking other people over to get to it. Okay? Even if after I take one or two bites, I'm not going to want to finish the rest, which people who give parties for kids often discover that all these beautiful sweets are left over, finally. Even the kids can't, most of them can't finish it, you know? All right? So in that case, what's happening is an exaggeration. Saying I like something, that's not an exaggeration. Saying I find it pleasant, good tasting, that's not an exaggeration. But thinking that it has a goodness to it, far in excess of whatever goodness it does possess, that's an exaggeration. And so the stronger the exaggeration for an attractive object, the more the delusion of attachment, desirous attachment arises. And the stronger the exaggeration for an unattractive object, something that we see bad, distasteful, eventually leads to a feeling of hatred, you know? And then that disturbing emotion arises. So it's from an exaggerated view. According to one of the formulations in the teachings, that this view, instead of calling it exaggeration, they sometimes call it overestimation and underestimation. Sometimes you'll find that expression in the teachings. So, I like something, okay. I find it good, okay. But now then there comes an overestimation, you know. We endow it with a value that it doesn't possess from its own side. And therefore our relation with that object is bound sooner or later to be disappointing. And on the way it leads to the arisal of those afflictions, such as that sticky, desirous attachment, right? And then the opposite is true for those objects that we find distasteful. You know, it's not merely, oh, I don't prefer that. It's, I hate that, right? How dare you serve me that? Don't you know I can't stand that food, right? And there's almost a sense of being insulted by the presence of something that we don't like, as if the universe is out to get us, right? To disappoint us. So this overestimation or underestimation, this exaggeration, whichever way you want to express it, all derives from a misunderstanding of that aspect of reality, that impermanent aspect. Okay? Yes, please. I see people are getting trained to wait for the microphone. I forget every time.
I was just curious about the concept that impermanence and ultimately is leads to a digression in its appeal or its value, perceived value. It seems to me that there may be things in the universe that, as they change, become more valuable or are perceived as more valuable. Is that an important? Is that true? And is it significant?
I'm not sure about that. Can you give me an example of something that accords with that view?
My wife is saying artwork, but I'm saying perhaps a plant. We see a plant as a seed. Mm-hmm. It's not terribly attractive.
Right, but when it grows into a flower, then it is attractive.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's all I need to ask, I think.
Okay. Well, no, that's a good point. I'm not sure my response will completely answer it, but that's something that's worth investigating. The fact that things change from moment to moment doesn't deny the fact that they can evolve into shapes or forms that we find more attractive or less attractive. I mean, you can go, that can definitely happen. It's more a reflection that if an object appears to us, let's start with it being attractive, you know. Actually, I guess with an analysis we can start it either of three ways. It starts being attractive, unattractive, or neutral. Okay? So the seed, from your point of view, is kind of not particularly attractive or unattractive. It's kind of neutral, right? And to those things that appear to our minds as kind of neutral, our tendency is to be kind of indifferent to them. You know, not pay that much attention to them. It doesn't seem to be helping me. It doesn't seem to be harming me. It's neither pleasing me nor displeasing me. And therefore we tend to maybe ignore is too strong a word, but there's a sense of indifference to it. But then, as it evolves, it may take a shape that we find attractive, right? Like a particularly beautiful flower, okay? Now at this point, it is appearing in an attractive mode, and if we're not, you know, fully trained, or if not well trained in the fact that this is an impermanent phenomena, that this beauty is not going to last, we can really become quite attached to that beautiful object. So much so that if someone comes along and accidentally knocks over the vase in which that flower is sitting, and the vase breaks and the flower gets crushed, we can really be upset. Right? Because now the flower is showing its impermanent nature. We don't have to wait for it because it's lying crushed on the floor in front of us. Right? Well, to the extent that we are holding on to a permanently attractive flower, its demise is painful. Whereas for someone who is better trained in that, they might be momentarily disappointed. You know, they prefer it wasn't destroyed, but it wasn't going to last forever anyway, right? And then sometime later in the process, assuming that that flower wasn't broken, you know, the vase wasn't knocked over, then at a certain point, then the flower starts to wilt. And this is a hard example to use because in my house, very often the most beautiful flowers are in the stages when they've wilted. My wife and I have noticed that if we have a flower up on some shelf somewhere, and it's quite beautiful, that even when it's wilting, it actually has an extraordinary beauty to it in that wilted stage. But at some point, usually it happens that this flower is not attractive anymore, and we want to throw it away, right? And so it's how things are appearing at the moment. When it appears neutral, our attention is, our attitude is one of more or less indifference. If it appears attractive, our attitude is more or less of wanting to possess it, to keep it, you know? And if its appearance is unattractive, our tendency is want to get rid of it, you know, to get it out of our sight. It's no longer attractive. We no longer put it on display. Okay? So in each case, we are relating to its momentary appearance as if that were its final appearance. You know, that the seed is a seed, that the beautiful flower is a beautiful flower. You know, that the ugly wilted flower is an ugly wilted flower, if that's, you know, the appearance. And it not only is these things, but it always will be these things, even though it's constantly changing. Okay? So, yes, things change over time, and they can change into forms that we find more attractive, but the basic thing is that they are changing. That the extent that we want to freeze them in that present moment automatically puts our attitude towards that object, puts it into an unreal sphere, and a sphere in which our expectations cannot possibly be met. One other example of this, where I live in California, is right next to the beach. And when my kids were little, I used to like to go there with them a lot. And making sandcastles at the beach was something I liked to do when I was a kid, and my kids like to do, most kids like to do, build something out of a wet sand. And maybe you've seen this experience, or maybe you can remember it from your own childhood, but think of the, in some cases, literally hours that are spent constructing something, you know, a mound out of wet sand in the shape of a castle or whatever it might be, you know. And all that effort that's put into making it. And then what happens when that thing that we've constructed over such a long period of time with such devotion starts to dry out, and then the waves start encroaching and erodes that object away, whatever it is. For a child who isn't fully conversant, you know, with the nature of seaside reality, right? The castle that was built appears to be permanent, and it should be permanent. I just spent an hour building it, right? With all that energy, with all that concentration that the child might not show in schoolwork, it shows in making such a sandcastle, right? And so when the waves start to wash it away, it's not unusual for the child to burst into tears. Right? Now, after a while, the child's intelligence grows based on experience and realizes, okay, I can spend this time building it, but it's wrong for me to think that it's going to last forever, that what I built here this afternoon is going to be here later in the afternoon or this evening or tomorrow, because the wind or the waves or something is going to destroy it, because that's the nature of building something out of wet sand. Okay? So it's a matter of, in some cases, of simply maturing, of having more experience, knowing the kind of the ground rules of our reality. You know, that the objects that we see, hear, smell, taste, and touch are by nature impermanent. And so we can still spend profitably hours building sandcastles, but we're not grasping onto the idea that what we build is going to be permanent. And therefore we can enjoy it for what it is, and then, like they say in the 60s, then just go with the flow. Right? And speaking about going with the flow, this would be a good time to take a 10 or 15 minute break. So at about 15 minutes from now, I'll ring this gong. According to my clock, that'll be 11:25. Does that seem reasonable? Yeah? Okay. Okay, so I'd like to continue with these introductory notes. I ask your patience and forgiveness for this. People might think, well, you know, when are we actually going to reach this text itself? But from my point of view, this background information, and it's just my own personal preference, that without this kind of background information, then just jumping into the text, it can be helpful, it can be taught that way, but I often have the feeling that we're really missing out the fundamental basis on which the teachings are established. And then if we get a little bit more familiarity with that, then we can always, you know, become acquainted with the text through other teachings or readings and so forth. But this approach for me is the most comfortable. But it can be frustrating for people who are expecting something and don't feel they're receiving it. So if that's the case, I apologize for that. But there's a reason, a pedagogic reason in my own mind, because I can only except when you ask questions, right, then it's hard for me to know what's on your mind or what you want to hear, so I can only speak of what I find interesting and helpful, okay? So that combination of your questions and my wandering will eventually, hopefully, lead us to the text itself. Okay. So, recapping the idea that behind the arisal of any disturbing emotion is the presence of some view that is in one way or another out of sync with reality. And the most the most obvious of these is relating to things which are by their own nature impermanent, always changing, as if they had an unchanging nature. And then holding on to that unchanging nature, either thinking it's unchangingly good or unchangingly bad, automatically gives rise to the delusions, the disturbances, which cause problems. So, so at the end of number three, it said, as a result of this this mistaken view, of permanence, it says we exaggerate the badness of an unattractive object, the goodness of an attractive object, causing us to generate anger and hatred towards the former and desirous attachment towards the latter. Okay? Now following on from that, number four, it says, in turn, such disturbing emotions as hatred and greedy attachment cause us to speak and act in ways that are harmful to others, thereby producing unwanted suffering for ourselves through the workings of karmic cause and effect. Okay? Now, this line indicates that when a disturbing emotion arises, okay, that itself is a mental karma, it's a mental activity, and it produces a certain amount of suffering in its wake, you know, as a consequence of that. Just harboring thoughts of hatred, for example, you can see. just having that in mind causes ulcers to grow. There's a direct connection between just having a harmful thought and experiencing a harmful result. You know, you don't have to wait for lifetimes. Right? But in addition to the mental karma of the affliction itself, there can be the verbal and physical karma when we act on that disturbing emotion. So if we're really very, very angry at someone for some reason, we can say something cutting and harsh. We can engage in some physical action that's harmful, that's painful. And in that case, we're further ingraining the impression of that disturbing emotion. So it says in number four, in turn, such disturbing emotions as hatred and greedy attachment cause us to speak and act in ways that are harmful to others, thereby producing unwanted suffering for ourselves through the workings of karmic cause and effect. Now this itself is a very, very large topic, that how it is that as the result of a disturbing emotion, the actions we engage in set in motion a series of cause and effects which eventually come back to ourselves in the form of suffering. And you might be happy to know, since I've been kind of joking that we've never reached the text, that we might never reach the text, is actually this this discussion of understanding the way in which karmic cause and effect work. That is actually part of the first of the 7 points of the mind training text, you know, under the preliminary practices. So the kinds of things that are discussed here aren't separate from the main body of the teachings, but is indicated right in the preliminary practices themselves. Okay. But this is a huge topic, and that we don't have to go into that here. Just simply that our actions do have consequences for ourselves. As many of you have heard, the image that's often used is that when we engage in mental, verbal, or physical actions, intended actions, actions with full intention, then it leaves an impression on our stream of consciousness, or sometimes they say plants a seed. well, a seed or an impression is a physical object, and the mind is not physical. So these are analogies. But some form of energy is embedded onto the stream of consciousness in such a way that in the future, which could be a few minutes from now, or it could be lifetimes from now, when we encounter the appropriate circumstances, a seed planted in hatred leads to suffering. A seed planted in love and compassion sprouts in an experience of happiness. So even though karma is a complex subject, and particularly in some respects a most subtle subject, some of the intricacies of karma, it is said, are only seen directly by a fully enlightened being. There is one aspect of karma that's very simple and straightforward, and that is that good leads to good and bad leads to bad. So a negative state of mind can only be the cause of suffering. A positive state of mind can only be the cause of happiness. So that aspect of karma is very simple. Whether we investigate it clearly enough to become convinced that that's true, that's another matter. But the statement of it is very simple. Okay. All right. Now, that view, that mistaken view of impermanence, let's say the permanent conception, viewing impermanent phenomena as if they were lasting and unchanging, that is just the first of three views that the Buddha pointed out were responsible, three distorted views that are responsible for our suffering. Okay? So the first one, just to repeat, is viewing impermanent phenomena as permanent. This is now listed in paragraph number 5, right? But in addition, the second mistaken view is viewing those things which are not capable of giving us true happiness as if they were capable of doing so. Right? And we've already started to talk a little bit about that, you know, like that kid at the birthday party who sees that, you know, rich piece of cake and eyes kind of bug out. To that kid, in that point of view, it's like, if I were to get that piece of cake, right, I would be really happy, right? In other words, in not simply that it seems permanent, but it seems like it's the very nature of nirvana itself, you know? It's like ultimate goodness, okay? Now, my language is kind of exaggerating at this point, but is the thought exaggerated, or does it meet with your experience? When things seem to be attractive, don't they seem to have a quality of a kind of an innate ability to give us what we're looking for, what we're hoping to find in this life?
The real thing.
The real thing. Peace, satisfaction, Coca-Cola, whatever the real thing is, you know? And so anyway, again, as is true for the whole range of the Buddha's teachings, it's not simply that by quoting something the Buddha or the other great master said that we then just simply accept it as true. It's that we use it as a basis for exploring our experience. Do we do this? Are there times when something is in the offing and we approach it with the kind of anticipation that nothing can live up to? You know? If our anticipation is within certain bounds, you know, like we're going to go, let's say we like a certain type of classical music, for example, and so we're going to go to a concert where they're going to play a piece that we like. So it's a reasonable expectation to think that they're going to play a piece that I've liked in the past. There's a really good chance I'm going to enjoy this concert, right? If our expectation stays within that section, there's no particular problem, no matter what happens, because we've just anticipated it to the level of a probability or a possibility, right? But if we hold on to, oh, the tickets cost me so much money and I had to rearrange my schedule and, you know, I had to do all this to get to go there, and then we go and we listen to it and it's just not the experience we expected, right? then because our anticipation has fallen into this second trap, then instead of saying, well, easy come, easy go, it's tremendous disappointment, great anger. I remember at one point, there was a period of a few weeks in my life that I lived as a jet setter. I was living in California, but I was invited to teach in Denver for about a 10-week period, I think, I seem to recall it was. And what happened was that they flew me and somebody else from California who was also teaching, they flew us both back and forth between California and Denver and put us up in a hotel and that whole thing. So, you know, for 10 weeks I was, you know, faking that I was living the lifestyle of the rich and famous, flying here and there and like that. And one of the things I remember is that at one time a number of us went out to a restaurant. And I enjoyed the meal. But after it was over, I heard these other people who were at the meal with me just explaining of how disappointing the meal was, you know. It was like they felt, well, they're used to going out to eat where every meal is this absolute delight, and this just didn't meet their standards, and they really were upset. And for me, I was really happy. I don't go out to eat that often, especially at a restaurant connected with a hotel or that kind of living, you know. So for me, I really, really liked it. But for them, it was at best second rate. Right? So we were eating the same food, but our expectation level was completely different. For me, I was more than satisfied. I was delighted. For them, they were really disappointed. Right? And of course, there are things that happen in my life which are exactly the opposite, where something which is water off the duck's back, you know, for them, really pisses me off because I was grasping onto something, expecting something that didn't happen. So this second misconception, this distorted view, thinking things which have, from their own side, do not have the ability to give us what we're hoping to find. You know, to quote the Coca-Cola commercial, you know, viewing them as if they did have that ability becomes the cause of great, great frustration and disappointment and many levels of dissatisfaction and suffering. Okay. But I won't say anything more about that. I think that's fairly obvious. But both of these views, the views regarding impermanent phenomena, the view regarding phenomena which don't have the ability to give us the happiness that we're looking for, are based on or derived from a deeper mistaken view, the third one. And as you either know already or have guessed, the third one brings us to the view of emptiness. Okay? So the third view is sometimes expressed as it is here, viewing that phenomena which lack independent self-existence, viewing them as if they actually possessed such independent or inherent existence. Okay? Now this is one of those areas of the Buddhist teachings where even the best possible words that we can come up with, right, don't have the ability to convey to our mind the depth of meaning that lies behind it. We can only kind of surround the insight which is meant by this undermining this third misconception. We can only surround it with different approaches, different vocabulary, and so forth. But no matter how perfect the word is that we come up with, it's incapable of giving us the direct vision of reality itself. Okay? There is a quotation, I don't have it exact in my mind, but there's a quotation, I think it's from the teachings of Maitreya Buddha, where it says the ultimate nature of reality is beyond thoughts, words, and expressions. Okay? Now some people take that to mean that the ultimate level of reality, the actual way things exist is unknowable. Some people take that to mean, but it doesn't mean that it's unknowable. It's still knowable, but it's not knowable through that medium of the way in which our conceptual mind ordinarily works. We have to get to a different level of experience, and the Buddhist teachings provide a roadmap for getting into that space. But the words can be more or less skillful to the extent to which they point us in the right direction. Okay? And so there's this famous analogy which is often used, that the Buddhist teachings is like the finger pointing to the moon. If we get distracted and think that the pointing finger is what we are meant to have insight about, and we focus just on that, then we lose sight of the ultimate aim, which is the moon. Okay? So the pointing finger is not the moon, but it can direct our attention to where the moon is. And in a similar fashion, the words of the teachings of all the great masters, Buddha, Nagarjuna, Chandrakirti, Shantideva, Atisha, Lama Tsongkhapa, all of these are skillful ways of using language to help us point in the right direction. But we're never going to come up with an expression which, when we read it, unless we have great instincts from the past, we're not going to suddenly read a phrase and think, oh, now I understand it. Now I understand what it means that things are empty of inherent existence. Okay? So I wanted to say that at the beginning, because if the language is not perfectly clear, if it's not perfectly transparent, if it doesn't completely communicate meaning, well, that's the nature of this particular subject, that it is beyond the scope of words and concepts. And a way we can think of it is, let's say, using a very non-Buddhist analogy, let's say we're interested in catching fish, and the fish that we're interested in catching are quite small. You know, like sardines or something like that. Okay. But the net that we're using has very, very big holes in it, like this. Right? Then no matter how much we fish with that net, we're not going to be able to catch the fish that we want. Right? We'd have to use a much finer net. And words are, you know, words, thoughts, expressions are just too gross to capture the meaning of that's intended by the fact that things are empty of inherent existence. Okay? But we can get, the words can bring us closer and closer to that understanding. Okay? So I'm going to say a little bit more about that after, you know, in either at the end of this time or this afternoon, when we turn to what's on page 2 and 3, a few words on emptiness, because this will kind of give us an idea of the approach that we can take to begin to cultivate this more accurate view of the nature of reality, which underlies our ability to banish the other mistaken views, like viewing impermanent things as permanent and things that can't give us true happiness as if they could give us true happiness, because both of those are based on a misunderstanding of this subtle wisdom of emptiness, this lack of inherent existence. Okay? So we'll have a little bit more to say about that. So the next paragraph, 6, just kind of summarizes that. The third of these three distorted views underlies the first two and is the fundamental cause of all suffering and dissatisfaction. That's a very, very powerful and very radical statement of the Buddha, is that if there is an experience of suffering or dissatisfaction, if we search, we'll find that the fundamental cause of it is exactly this mistaken view. This mistaken view that views phenomena which are not inherently existent as if they were inherently existent. And apparently there's no exceptions to that. All suffering, dissatisfaction can be traced back to that. Now that doesn't, on the surface, appear necessarily to be true. You know? Because, for instance, the weather has been quite lovely since I've been here. Last night it was a bit chilly. Okay? It wasn't a problem. It wasn't a big problem. But if it had gotten a little bit colder, I would have felt cold. I would have shivered. And that could be thought of as an experience of suffering or dissatisfaction, you know. I need another blanket. Right? It was uncomfortable. So it's not immediately obvious that holding on to a mistaken view of the nature of reality caused me to suffer. I would say, no, the fact that the weather got colder caused me to suffer. Well, the distinction that's being made is that there are conditions which can bring about a suffering result, right? But the actual cause of that suffering result is fundamentally an attitude of mind, right? So if we didn't have a certain seed for a suffering experience, then whether we were hot or cold or whatever the outward condition might be, that by itself wouldn't cause suffering and dissatisfaction to arise. There must have been a seed planted in the past, and that seed, a seed of karmic instinct, was planted by a delusion, and the delusion arises because of a misunderstanding of the nature of reality. So we have to distinguish between the deep causes of a suffering situation, or, by extension, the deep cause of a happy experience, and the conditions which surround them, which bring them about, because there is a distinction between those two. Okay. Yes, Naga, did you?
If you're saying that we have the seed, can we eliminate the seed if people are dying and people are being killed? How can we not suffer? Am I clear on my question?
It seemed like there were two things there.
Okay.
There's a seed for suffering.
Right. So if people are dying right in front of us,
yeah,
and we suffer when we watch that. So can we erase that seed of seeing people dying and still not be suffering about it?
Okay, that's actually, it doesn't sound like it, but it's actually mixing several things together. Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can draw them apart. First of all, in this world of ours, there are certain things that happen that are sad. You know? Whether you were an ordinary being like myself, or a superior being like Buddha or the Dalai Lama, you know, the fact that the injustice in the world, loved ones dying, all these things, these are sad. You know, that doesn't stop being sad. You know, when we gain insight. But what's our reaction to things that are sad? That's where the question comes in. You know, sometimes when people see a sad situation, it just makes them feel more compassionate, more connected, right? It actually causes their heart to become stronger. But a lot of times, in response to a sad situation, people rail against fate. They get angry, you know, and so they take the inevitable suffering that exists as long as we have an impermanent body, Because as long as we have an impermanent body, if we had a body of light, that's something else. But as long as we have a body made up of, you know, flesh and solid matter, we're going to have to experience the difficulties related to birth and old age and death of ourselves and others. So there's inevitably going to be situations that are sad. But whether we react to that sadness with suffering, that's another matter. One teacher I heard said, in this life of ours, pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. So that phrase is drawing a distinction between certain things that are just part of our nature because of our physical makeup and the additional suffering that's added on top of it by having an attitude which is fundamentally unrealistic. You know? So people who wail over the death of someone, you know, they don't simply feel sad about it, you know. They react to it in this exaggerated way, are piling unnecessary suffering on inevitable pain. And that very, very much is what the teachings are trying to get us to understand, that there are certain givens in this life, as long as we're starting out with this imperfect body-mind combination, which will be painful, right? But whether we react to it in this exaggerated way with suffering, that's something else, right? So seeing a loved one die, for instance, that's not the seed of suffering. That's, you know, this, a seed of suffering is something that's planted in the past. This is just a current experience. Whether that becomes the condition for a suffering response depends on how realistic our view of reality is. You know? I wanted to say one thing, and I definitely don't mean what I'm to say as a criticism of any religion or religious followers. I just want to take it as an example because it was broadcast very widely, and it made a big impression on me at the time. It was at the time that Pope John Paul II was passing away in Rome. And if you remember, he manifested this illness towards the end of his life. And so the dying process went on for a while. And they, of course, interviewed people in St. Peter's Square who have this incredible faith and devotion to him. And they also had different doctors being interviewed who were part of his treatment. And it came out in those interviews that he had reached a certain state of organ failure in which people don't recover. There's, you know, I don't know whether it was kidney or what it was, but there was some organ failure, and he had reached that state. So it was a matter of time. Well, what I found really interesting was that they were interviewing people in St. Peter's Square, and there were people there, very, very sincere, very deeply feeling people, and I felt great empathy for them, who were still praying for a miracle that he would recover. Okay. Now, I completely related to that wish. You know, I mean, had it been one of my teachers, I would have felt the same thing, you know. But at a certain point, wishing for a miracle is like denying the nature of the reality that you're, that we're dealing with, the cards that are, that we're all dealt. You know, better to think, you know, that the person who's dying experiences a peaceful transition, or pray for their, depending on your philosophical point of view, pray for their trip to heaven or positive rebirth, whatever it is, whatever fits in your own point of view. but to basically deny the dying process because you don't want this loved person to die, that's just adding more suffering. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I'm not doing that as a criticism because that's a completely human reaction. And I compare it with something that I heard Kepje Zopa Rinpoche say when Lama Yeshe was in Los Angeles right at the very end of his life, and they tried all of these various procedures to revive him because he experienced this massive heart failure and so forth. And at a certain point, I was told, I wasn't there, I was told Lama Zopa asked the doctors, he said, has any of the patients that you've treated in the past who have reached this point and you've done all of these interventions on, has any of them survived? And the doctor said, no, you know, at this point there's been zero rate of survival. So then Lama Zopa said, okay, so at this point you can leave off those procedures. So up to that point, when there was still a possibility, he would allow, you know, the doctors to do what they could. But at a certain point, when reality sets in, right, that survival at this point is not possible. You know, if someone is stumbling towards the end of a cliff, you can keep them from falling off. But once they've stepped off the edge of the cliff, the laws of gravity take over. And it doesn't matter what you think. You're not going to repeal those laws. That person is going to fall. Okay? So in a similar fashion, accepting the impermanent nature of reality allows us to do those things that we can do, you know, and rest satisfied with those things that we can't, and shift our attention in such a way that we can deal with things that are sad without being completely crushed by them, without building up a level of expectation which can't be fulfilled. Okay. So it's time to stop. So I'm just simply going to read 7 and 8, and that'll set the stage for turning to the few words on emptiness when we come back this afternoon. So, the importance of uprooting all such distorted or wrong views is emphasized by Buddha's having listed right view as the very first of the 8 trainings that make up the Eightfold Path leading to liberation. And as many of you know, the remaining 7 right views, qualities are right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And that was what the Buddha said in his very first discourse on turning the wheel of Dharma when he was discussing the Four Noble Truths. Okay, but right view had the pride of place of being the very first one because that is what is going to be the ultimate antidote for suffering and dissatisfaction. Okay, cultivating that view, which largely is a matter of overcoming the wrong views. Okay. And then the last one. As stated in the opening verses of the Buddha's Dharmapada, and by the way, this is a collection of the Buddha's sayings that are very, very ancient and has been translated many, many times, and many, many poetic translations have been done. And if you haven't read it, if you haven't opened up a volume of the Dharmapada, I very much suggest it. It's a series of sayings or aphorisms collected from the whole scope of Buddhist teachings and organized according to certain themes. And the very first chapter, if you want to call it, it's just a page long of different sayings, are called the twin verses because in them the structure of what the Buddha is saying is almost like in the form of a mirror or twin images where he says one thing and then he says another thing in a very similar fashion. So the very first of these twin verses in this collection of the Dharmapada is and this is an abbreviated version of it. I've left out a few of the words. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. If we speak or act with an impure thought, suffering follows as the wheel of a cart follows the foot of the ox that draws it. Then, in the twin verses, the second verse repeats the beginning. All that we are is the result of what we have thought. If we speak or act with a pure thought, happiness follows us like a shadow that never leaves. So this statement, this very, very, very brief statement, has what I would call pride of place as being the first quotation in the Dharmapada, because it points to the whole series of causes and effects, which on one point of view, it engaged in an improper, unrealistic manner, leads to unwanted suffering, but if engaged in a way that accords with the nature of reality, leads to happiness. Okay. So, we can make our own brief dedication. I think I'll leave a longer dedication for the end of the afternoon session, so we can think if there's been any value here, and we can dedicate it in the ways that we find most appropriate. And otherwise, we'll break for lunch, and maybe we'll aim to be back instead of at 1:30. Why don't we make it 1:40? Okay, because I went over about 8 or 9 minutes. So we'll aim to be back at 1:40. And then just as a reminder of what Adana said, was towards the end of that lunch break sometime, there'll be a chance to see the video by His Holiness. I think you'll enjoy it. I think you'll find it quite interesting. Okay. Thank you very much. And bon appétit.